Sure.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Connie Richard, the appellant and plaintiff in this matter. I brought various complaints of racial discrimination, retaliation, hostile work environment, and disparate impact under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 against the U.S. Department of Transportation. All claims were dismissed largely under the theory that I failed to exhaust administrative remedies. Under the facts of this case, I used formal and informal counseling to effect all requirements of notice to the Department of Transportation, giving DOT every opportunity for the agency to investigate my claims. Yet DOT, when it initiated an investigation, it never completed it, and it did so grudgingly.
I'm sorry, it never completed it, and it did what grudgingly?
The investigation, when it did initiate it,
so it initiated it something but never completed it. Okay.
That's right.
Okay.
The Supreme Court has basically classified exhaustion of remedies as non-jurisdictional because in enacting Title VII, Congress did not expressly state that failure to exhaust administrative remedies is jurisdictional. And in this court, Brown v. Marshall had a very good discussion of that particular principle. More recently, this circuit has looked at the issue of exhaustion of remedies in Otis v. Bernanke. And in that case, the court said, counseling is designed to enable the agency and its employee, quote, to try to informally resolve the matter before an administrative charge is filed. And the purpose of the administrative exhaustion doctrine is to afford the opportunity to resolve the matter internally and to avoid unnecessarily burdening the court and give the employee and employing office an opportunity to explore and possibly resolve the employee's claims informally. And there have been a variety of cases in this circuit that seem to support that contention and support the facts in this case. And in my view, the district court, both Judge Penn and Judge Walton, failed to recognize legal precedent in this circuit when it dismissed all of the claims in the case. Initially, Judge Penn had dismissed all claims except the retaliation one, and subsequently Judge Walton dismissed that remaining claim.
So your second, third, and fourth counts were dismissed but in the first opinion, Judge Penn?
Yes.
Okay.
That's right. And the declaratory judgment and the constitutional issues of due process that I raised, because that's an area that it's rarely pursued because people believe, I think, that the discrimination laws as enacted by Congress may be adequate, but to my knowledge, there's been no preemption that is an off-limit category of relief, even for a federal employee. And even if there were any defects in my administrative process, I cured them by amending my administrative complaint systematically as issues arose. And during the litigation, I also supplemented the complaint regarding my alleged removal from office from the Federal Service in January 1988, to which I appealed that ruling. And it was returned to the district court for determination on the merits, which, of course, never happened. This is also a disparate impact claim. And To some extent, disparate impact claims void the need for administrative requirement. And the Supreme Court of the United States has held that a plaintiff who does not file a timely charge challenging the adoption of a practice is not foreclosed by a lack of timely administrative charge issue. After all, in Lewis v. City of Chicago. And here, of course, we know that the primary purpose is not to establish a record, but is to try and resolve the issue informally. I have itemized many issues in great detail in my complaint, and to some extent that was a good thing since this case is now 24 years old, and therefore I am 24 years older, and so is everyone else involved in the case. And so memories tend to fade, and therefore it has certainly proved as a very instructive document for that purpose.
Well, so far one judge has died out of the case. We'd like to hold it at that.
I'm sorry?
I'd like to keep it to just one judge dying during the pendency of this case. Yeah, so. Ms. Richard, you're into your rebuttal time, so if you want to conserve it.
I'm sorry?
Am I correct? Yes. You've used your... How much time did you reserve for rebuttal?
Five.
You're into it.
Well, can I make it two?
Sure. Go right ahead.
A minute and 41. Okay, as far as the discovery issue, here again, I was not able to call any of the individuals who could have assisted me, and I couldn't go to them myself for an affidavit because they still fear the power of the United States government. Either they still work there or they work in the federal service, or even if they are retired, people want to maintain their social contacts or whatever. So there is this cloud and difficulty in getting people to assist you. And even in the Artis v. Bernanke case, excuse me. That court held discovery on the issue of exhaustion of remedies. Here, both judges have simply glossed over it and made a ruling against me. I was also in a hostile work environment over a long period of time. I itemized many kinds of things involving meetings, assignments, staff meeting, international travel, making it very, very difficult for me to feel that I was free to take action to pursue my claims in a more formal manner. I'm going to reserve the rest of the time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Assistant United States Attorney Matt Jones on behalf of Secretary of Transportation Raymond LaHood. I'd just like to briefly respond to Ms. Richard's primary argument on appeal regarding equitable tolling and then answer any questions that the court may have. Ms. Richard's argument at bottom is that she is entitled to the extraordinary relief of equitable excusal from her failure to exhaust her administrative remedies because her coworker was permitted to go on an international business trip. That does not suffice to excuse failure of exhaustion of administrative remedies. She does not claim that she was unaware of the administrative remedies available to her. To the contrary, she states in her complaint at paragraph 18 that she expressly declined to pursue a formal complaint in 1984. She doesn't say that the government misled her about how to go about pursuing her administrative remedies. She doesn't say she was lulled into inaction by some government promise to placate her. She doesn't say that she was otherwise prevented or restrained from filing a formal administrative complaint. She claims that following a meeting with a Department of Transportation Office of Civil Rights employee in either 1983 or 1984, that her supervisors permitted a less educated African-American female coworker to travel as part of an international delegation on an overseas trip. That simply does not suffice under any equitable doctrine to excuse the failure to exhaust administrative remedies. She has put forward no authority, and the government is not aware of any, for the proposition that that would suffice.
Mr. Jones, I know you're familiar with the case of Amtrak against Morgan.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because you discussed it at page 20 of your brief. There is a section in there, 2074 of the Supreme Court Reporter, saying it does not matter for purposes of the statute that some of the component acts of the hostile work environment, and we do have that kind of a claim in front of us.
I'll
go back to and let you dispute that, if we have such a claim in front of us, that some of the component acts of the hostile work environment fall outside the statutory time period. Provided that an act contributing to the claim occurs within the filing period, the entire time period of the hostile environment may be considered for the purpose of determining liability. There's a section in Ms. Richard's brief that specifically is headed and argues hostile work environment. And the second, third, and fourth counts of her complaint seem to go to that. Third claim being headed racial discrimination designed to force plaintiff to leave the agency. There's another one, I'm not sure it's in the heading, that's repeated at 123 in the fourth claim. And there's another place where the magic words hostile work environment are used. So why isn't the district court decision incomplete in that it treats the three incidents or several incidents seriatim individually rather than cumulatively with respect to, and therefore with respect to hostile work environment?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that Ms. Richard squarely presented to the district court any idea that these were hostile work environment claims. The claims, I think the one that most clearly could be seen as a hostile work environment claim is the second claim for professional suppression in the work environment. It doesn't go to traditional employment action, but goes to things like opportunities for travel, work assignments, derogatory comments from coworkers. And
in the fourth claim, there are express references to efforts to force Ms. Richard to leave the agency.
Regardless, Your Honor, the district court need not have addressed it that way because all of those claims end prior to the point at which Ms. Richard needed to timely bring them to the court.
Well, there are some events that occurred later on, I believe, that under the Morgan analysis might relate back.
I believe that the second claim, the professional suppression claim, mm-hmm. relates to the time between 1982 and April 1985 when Ms. Richard was in the international office. Then did you say the third claim goes to her details, which go from April 85 until she's informed of the final detail in October of 1986.
Let me see if I can keep up with you. At 119, she says, beginning in November 1986, plaintiff was forced to be interviewed just as if she was not a member of the civil service. That's part of the third claim for relief on being pushed to leave the agency. The paragraph is 28, bottom right. That's within the period, isn't it?
No, Your Honor. At the time, the then-controlling regulations required notice or initiation of contact with an EEO counselor within 30 days. I believe December 18th is the date, so it goes back to November 18th.
Well, it says beginning in November. Doesn't say that it ended in November, let alone by the 18th.
I think it's a fair inference from the record that it would have ended before then, as by the beginning of December 1986, she's already been assigned to a new job, so there's no longer any need
for
her to
be. On the question of whether beginning in November 1986 should be read in context to mean an ending sometime before November 18th, isn't it relevant that we've got a pro se plaintiff here?
It's relevant to some degree. I think it's less so given that Ms. Richard is a trained attorney, a Georgetown trained lawyer, and that she has proven herself.
Okay, let's put that one aside. What about December 1st? page 121. On December 1, 1986, plaintiff was forcibly removed from Mr. Skakosa's suite. This is brought within claim 3, racial discrimination designed to force plaintiff to leave the agency. Paragraph 33, I think.
Your Honor, first
32,
that...
31.
At first, I want to reiterate the point that the district court, neither district court, dealt with this issue.
That's the problem. They dealt with second, third, fourth claims and never asked about hostile work environment relating back.
I think that the district court didn't deal with them because Ms. Brashard didn't raise them. The difficulty here is...
Okay, tell me how they shouldn't raise them if they're in the complaint. Did she some later on waive them in some way?
No, because she didn't characterize it as a hostile work environment claim until coming before this court.
All right, I thought that even those magic words were in the complaint, but maybe not. Go ahead.
As you know from reviewing the complaint so carefully, Ms. Richard alleges more than four dozen acts of alleged discrimination or retaliation against more than a dozen employees of the Department of Transportation over a decade-long period. And given that fact, I think there's some onus on Ms. Richard to raise the hostile work environment claim a bit less obliquely at best than she ever did before the district court, either on the initial motions for summary judgment or on her two motions for reconsideration by two different judges that were considered and denied.
So the, what is it, creating an environment of professional suppression isn't close enough?
No, I think that is the claim that most clearly sounds in, could be construed as a hostile work environment. But again, this professional suppression claim relates to a job that she held only up until April 1985, and it was not until a year and a half later that Ms. Richard went to an EEO counselor about those concerns.
Okay, I have the point.
If the court has no additional questions, then the government would respectfully request that the judgment...
Just before you leave, I'm reminded...
Certainly, Your Honor.
...of Steele against Schaefer.
Yes.
In which we said you don't have to have the magic words, these magic words. Well, hostile work environment, right? You just have to describe a hostile work environment. This is a pretty good description of a hostile work environment, isn't it?
It may not have to appear in the complaint, but I think that if upon the issue of exhaustion of administrative remedies being raised, there is some onus upon the parties to raise the hostile work environment issue for the district court to consider them. She never raised it to Judge Penn or Judge Walton, and for that reason, I think that the district court did a proper, fair, thorough job in reviewing the claims that she did raise.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I only have 2 minutes, but as far as seeing actual EEOC counselors, I did see Cora Tyler. The government has never acknowledged that. They claim they searched their records and no such record was found of that communication. I don't have the exact time right now, but there was a previous contact with Cora Tyler, who is and was at that time a EEO officer. So therefore, those claims had begun, and they never end. Under the system that existed at that time, once you start the counseling period, it's open-ended until you actually proceed to the next step. So essentially, they were enfolded and encompassed into the subsequent one in 1987, December 1987. So that's one point that I want to make. And I repeated the suppression issues throughout all of my filings in my motions for summary judgment, because I went through the Diane Johnson high school graduate who was an assistant working on helping with statistics and was given this trip. And it was given to her intentionally, because I had raised these claims. And as far as The other item is anytime there's one relevant issue that's in, like, the December 18 contact with an EEO officer, historical progression of events are relevant to that. And they were, because this is the way things work in the government. If someone doesn't like you, then the other offices are communicated about what that problem is with that employee. And so even if you're moved someplace else, it just sort of follows you. So it wasn't necessarily an end to anything. So there is a continuous situation going on here, and I made my claims of hostile environment. I made my claims about disparate impact. I repeated these over and over, so the government misstated when it said it's not in the record.
And the district court is where they were saying. So
right. And the district court ignored what I wrote repeatedly. And and my being a lawyer now and a law student at that time should be commended, and it didn't apply when it came to promotion and Ms. LeSueur, who was given a 15 grade after I was summarily removed from the Federal Service.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Richard. We have
your
argument.
Much.
The case is submitted. Thank you all.